Good afternoon, everybody. I should almost say good evening. It's wonderful to have everyone here today on a beautiful, beautiful spring day to talk about important things. We must be doing something right because we've got a very distinguished crowd here. We have a Chancellor Emerita, Greta Chambers. We've got the Provost, still the Provost, Tony Massey. We've got the Vice President, Vice Principal of Research, Rosie Goldstein. We've got the Dean of Medicine and Vice Principal of Health Sciences. And I don't think we've ever been able to mobilize quite that array of senior administrators for our talks before. So welcome to everyone, but particularly to those. This is the 18th Sandra Goldberg Lecture. And we're so grateful to the Goldberg family because they have allowed us to bring to our community a series of outstanding people who have contributed to our knowledge and probably shaped our attitudes to a great degree. And we believe that this afternoon will be no exception. The Goldberg family, Lynn Goldberg, daughter of Sandra Goldberg, is here. As Neil McDonald is supposed to be here, I haven't seen him yet. He treated Sandra Goldberg when she died of cancer. And as a result of that relationship, this lectureship was established under the sponsorship of the Council on Palliative Care. I'm the co-chair with Cappy Flanders. Its mandate was projected before for your edification. We basically provide educational activities to the professional and non-professional community around us, and a real emphasis on the community, trying to help people learn how to cope with death and dying. And we serve as a very strong advocate for palliative care at the local, at the provincial, and at the national level. And we're so happy to have Madame Yvonne here, who, of course, has done so much more than we have, actually. This is, again, going to not be a formal lecture, quite obviously. We're going to have a dialogue between distinguished people, and that will be moderated by a very, very experienced moderator. Véronique Yvonne has been the member of the National Assembly for Joliet since December 2008. She was elected under the banner of the Parti Québécois in three consecutive elections. She holds degrees from McGill University in both civil and common law, as well as a master's in political analysis from the London School of Economics. She has also acted as a political advisor and deputy director of the offices of two ministers of justice, Serge Ménard and Le Goupil. Original instigator and vice president of the Special Commission on the Question of Dying with Dignity, when still in opposition, she was called upon to pilot the legislation on end-of-life care as the minister responsible from September 2012 till April 2014, when, of course, the Liberals were in power. I think a very wonderful expression of bipartisan service. During the same period, she was appointed minister in charge of social services and youth protection policies. She spanned the two administrations, as I should have said. And she distinguished herself by bringing forward the first policy paper on fighting homelessness and bringing public attention to those affected by autism or suffering from mental deficiencies, as well as studying the need to increase the funding of community working groups. Since April 24th, she's been the opposition critic on questions of culture, communications, higher educations, and end-of-life care. You know, when you look at what she's done, you realize that people really can accomplish something in public service. It's quite wonderful and quite impressive. We tend to get a little jaded sometime, but we mustn't forget that. Harvey Shipper, I'm going to have some trouble because very small print here for an old guy, is both an engineer and a physician who's combined the disciplines to bring innovation to health and life sciences sector from the research bench to the bedside and to public policy. His career has bridged five continents as a cancer specialist, innovator, health systems designer, businessman, and advisor to government, academe, and the corporate sector. As a physician, he was professor of medicine and director of the regional cancer care system in Manitoba, established the WHO Collaborating Center for Quality of Life Research in Cancer, which catalyzed patient-centered outcomes research on a global basis. He has helped design cancer programs around the world. Currently, he's professor of medicine at the University of Toronto. He has served as a corporate vice president of NBS, a strategic portfolio. His broad experience over more than 35 years has ranged from the bench to the bedside to national and international health systems, with a particular focus on healthcare delivery and policy. During his tenure at MDS, he was deeply involved in health venture capital allocation and has advised startups and established ventures ever since. His particular skill has been setting each initiative in the broad context of healthcare environment. His work with governments and large healthcare systems focuses on future orientation and transformation. And as our moderator, we have our Dean of Law and Wainwright Chair in Civil Law. Daniel Jutra has teaching and research interests in civil law and comparative law, and he now conducts research into the law of obligations from a comparative and pluralist perspective. He's also pursuing research projects on judicial institutions and civil procedures. He's frequently invited to speak on these issues. Interestingly enough, from 2002 to 2004, he was on leave from the faculty and acted as the personal secretary to Chief Justice of Canada, the Right Honourable Beverly McLaughlin, in the position of Executive Legal Officer of the Supreme Court of Canada. He's a former director of the Institute of Comparative Law and has served as Associate Dean Admissions and Associate Dean Academic in the faculty, and he is our moderator, and I am delighted to turn the podium over to him. He will run the podium from his chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dr. Cruz. This is wonderful. You've done all the difficult work, and now I have the pleasant work to do. So welcome to McGill. Welcome to this wonderful event. I want to remind you that we're here sitting on the podium because the temptation to watch the screen, I think, is unavoidable. I mean, all of us like to watch TV. And at some point, if you don't pay attention, we might lose eye contact. And that's really disorienting for people who are speaking at an event like this. So welcome. A few words on the order of the day, on how we're going to proceed. So instead of having speeches delivered by what academics like to refer to as talking heads, which I think is also used in the media, we thought we'd make this a bit more lively by having a conversation between our two guests. And my task is to take as little space as possible. So I will try to disappear as much as possible once I've launched your two guests in this conversation. I can assure you that will not be very difficult. We met for an hour just before this event began, and I had to stop them, actually. But it was very civil, as you will quickly realize. Madame Yvon va intervenir en français. So if there are...
Yvon will intervene in French. So if there's...
Yet a little machine out there, an earpiece that will enable you to follow the full scope of the debate. And as we were sitting, we agreed to do this in an informal way, so I will refer to our two speakers by their first name, if I can get myself to do that, and they've agreed to do the same. And then when you ask questions at the end, you can choose, I guess, to refer to them by their first name. So questions will be raised by the audience after the conversation, probably 45 minutes of conversation, then we'll open the floor for questions, and you've all received a little card on which you can write your question. Given the size of the audience and the number of people who wish to ask questions, we felt that it would be more efficient to gather the questions on pieces of paper that I will then sort, try to gather together on similar topics and raise with our speakers, and we will end promptly after about 15 minutes of question and answer. So in the spirit of launching the conversation, I thought I would begin by showing that our speakers are actually in agreement on much of the issues that we're going to talk about tonight, and in particular, in agreement about one aspect of this issue, which is the importance of thinking of assisted dying, which is the word that is now used in the Quebec bill that addresses end-of-life care. Think of assisted dying as part of a continuum of end-of-life care. And I know that both of our speakers think of this very carefully. Perhaps I will start with Véronique, who can explain why it was so important for the Quebec legislature to tie together the concept of assisted dying and the scope of end-of-life care.
Oui, c'est...
Fenvy. Well, yeah, that's a very good entry into this topic, because the legislation in Quebec is quite unique in its own way. In the world, it's the first legislation that really deals with the question on a whole spectrum, so a continuum of care. And the law, in spite of all the media attention that was given to it on the question of medical help to die, that's the expression retained in the law, that the attention is really on the end-of-life care. That's the title of the bill. Why we made that choice is because the end of care of life, end of life is not it is a step. What we wanted through the law is to accompany as best possible, responding best possible to the needs, the particular needs of the specific need of each person who is ending their lives with something appropriate to their circumstances. And this is why we want to give rights for palliative care, which we know will respond to the most of the needs. And on that spectrum where there are palliative care, the palliative sedation, even the possibility of having, of using medically assisted death. And so even the question of there are times when the best palliative care does not respond to everything.
Settings that you think that the focus on assisted dying that comes from the Supreme Court decision in Carter and the discussions that took place in Quebec in respect of legislation that was just mentioned, that all of this debate has actually distracted us from the significance of end-of-life care and palliative care more broadly. What do you mean by this?
Well, in preparing for today, and I must say I'm very honored to be here, and a number of my mentors are in the audience, so, you know, I prepared a little more carefully because all my teachers are there, you know. And I'm going to get marked.
No.
Anyway, as I thought about this, really, the fundamental issue is, why do we find ourselves in this spot? You know, if you take a broad historical view of medicine and go way, way back, Socrates started this conversation going, and he wasn't the first. And the issue of ending life early, of suicide, of assisted suicide, whatever the phraseology is, goes back a very, very long time, and it seems to go up and down and up and down. And my perception has been that it comes to the fore because of conditions in the community that make people nervous that they're going to be left alone, that they won't be able to receive the support they need, that they will be, if you will, to oversimplify the phrase, be left to suffer alone in one way or another. So I'm, honored to be sitting beside Véronique. We've had one phone call and now an hour and a half conversation, and realize that we have a lot of common ground, because I think we both come from that same position. What is there out there? And because that there's something out there, Quebec has led the world in creating a piece of legislation that addresses not only the notion of assisted suicide, which the media has jumped on, but what do you do to assure that people, that they are not going to be left wanting at time of real existential need, of when they are suffering? And that caused me to go around, and in fact I interviewed, I suppose, a collective of 200 people, from senior politicians to hospital administrators in advance of this. And we really came to the conclusion that what this bill can do is galvanize not just Quebec, but the country to say, we need to understand the needs of our community at times like this and make sure the services are there. And that implies changes in the way we educate our medical profession, the way we administer our medical profession, the way our hospitals work, the way insurance companies work, and the way we as individual persons, all of whom are going to travel this road at some point, prepare, come to terms for this kind of conversation. So I'm pleased that we did not say, hey, we're going to have a big debate about whether it's morally right or morally wrong, because you're never going to resolve that issue. There are going to be some people who say, under no circumstances should we allow this. And there are other people who are going to have a different view. The real issue is, how do we relieve the angst in the community? How do we make the need for this as little as possible? And those are very powerful impetuses for making progress across the whole healthcare scene. So you've got it as a piece of legislation. I can tell you that when I, you know, in Ontario, now people come to me and say, well, what are we going to do about this? College of Physicians says to me, what are we going to do about this? How do we have the conversation? Well, guess what? We didn't have the conversation before.
I think that I can add something here, which is the interest of having dialogue with the population. The way we did it, we always did it in a broad perspective. And the law, the bill, as the process, started from the perspective of the person who is the end-of-life situation, and how we could accompany this person as best as possible, and therefore all the principles that flowed from in the law, the rights that are there. And there's a reality behind all of this, that is there a will for people to be able to have an accompaniment and control even on the end-of-life situation, just to reflect on palliative care. The will to be able in the community promote as much as possible the care, homes for palliative care, as well as places in hospitals where care is given, as well in the places, also at home. Some people want to have palliative care at home. And so know that all those are fundamental possibilities and at the heart of the whole discussion and dialogue of accompanying people at the end of life. And so we agree on the fact that training and formation has to be improved, that palliative care has to be come earlier. I'm in the proletariat of pastoral of care. I think that we have to look at this much more broadly, that the doctors, the nurses, the social workers, the people have to internalize all this, because we need to deal with the people.
But let me point to one place I think where you disagree. So I know that you don't really feel that palliative care can cover all possible cases, that there are some limits to palliative care, and they may be near or far, but there's a point at which I think in your perspective and the perspective that animates legislation where something else needs to be done. Am I right?
Yes, with all the work that we did, the hearing the experts, looking at the evolution of medicine, of society itself, and also of rights or law, we became aware that there was a need for people to be sure that if the worst scenario might occur, which just doesn't happen, but it might happen, where people are experiencing heavy, heavy suffering, suffering and pain that are not controllable. If that happens, there has to be able to have an option, an exceptional option that's very circumscribed, but respond to this question of accompanying people till the end of their life, and to make sure that there's no suffering, and that responds to their needs, and that these persons still feel to be the persons that they were during their whole lives through sickness, because we respect also their perspective, their opinion, and the fact that suffering can, in certain circumstances, not be surrounded. This is not me, but as a legislator, I can't decide this. But having talked to hundreds of people through Quebec, with experts also, and there are a lot of people who said that, yes, they had they saw their child, their parent, their partner had palliative cares, but as in all cases, even medicine has limitations, and palliative medicine also has limitations. And this was our conviction, that we needed, for exceptional cases, offer a response made up of compassion and solidarity in their case. That's good.
Palliative care? Well, I think you can help us situate assisted dying, as it's provided for in the Act, along the spectrum of palliative care and the different kinds of interventions that one can imagine.
Well, I suppose the most traditional definition of palliative care, the one in the public perception, is often, interestingly, associated with cancer care. and people have came into the system, they got all their chemotherapy and their radiation, and there came a point where finally there was recognition that nothing could further be done, and they were passed on to the palliative care doctors who were there to relieve their pain. When you really think about that, that's a substantial failure of medicine. Because from the earliest moments, the notion of comprehensive understanding of your patient and alleviating suffering marches beside the notion of curing disease. The game isn't curing disease, it's taking care of a patient. So we backed ourselves into a kind of corner. And now we're trying to back ourselves out again. You know, oncology has, and I'm an oncologist, oncology has grown to the point where we're now starting to encompass notions of suffering identification, if you will, and the relief of suffering earlier on, and managing a continuum of care. But it wasn't that long ago, and we still had examples of patients who'd be in a hospital, say with lung cancer, and they'd be treated full bore with radiation and chemotherapy and all sorts of things, and they were clearly getting worse in everybody's eyes, except maybe the oncologist who said, I'm going to try one more thing. And then when that didn't work anymore, we had a terribly debilitated, disheartened, suffering as much from treatment patient, and we said, okay, over to the morphine guys. And that left patients terrified. It really, really did. And I think we're carrying that burden to today. I'm not a palliative care physician, but I've been involved in palliative care for a long time. And this is, in a good palliative care unit, the questions about assisted dying or whatever you want to call it very rarely come up. Where you see it is where people haven't had that kind of help establishing a perspective, getting their supports. When you think about the court cases that have come forward, of course, they're neurodegenerative. All right, and that's another kind of story. So the philosophic issue really is, what does the society do when you identify a very small number of problems you can't solve? All right? And there's a risk on either side of that equation. If you make the decision to change the rules, change what's a fundamental societal rule that you can't actively end someone's death, then you have to think of what are the consequences of doing that, having made things easier for a very defined set of people. On the other hand, if you decide not to do it, if you hadn't come forward with the legislation, if Quebec hadn't come forward with the legislation, we have the consequence of people whose suffering may not be adequately relieved. So that comes up against the moral wall, but the way I would go about saying that, all right, if you're going to make for this legislation, we have to be as explicit as we can be in territory in which it's almost impossible to be explicit except in the situation, and make a decision for an individual patient. Okay, we're going to do this or we're not going to. But the piece for me that is the real benefit down the line is, what do you do after? What do you do to learn from each and every circumstance in which that's happened? You know, in medicine, we have this long tradition of the morbidity and mortality conference. And we'd get together on the ward and we'd look at cases that had gone badly and said, what can we learn about them? It seems to me that for this very marked exception to traditional societal thinking, right, that as your legislation is partially set out, both at the local and, if you will, at the societal level, you're looking at each and every circumstance and saying, did we in fact do what we should have been able to do to relieve that suffering? If we didn't, how do we modify the things? So in effect, the real purpose of the Act could be interpreted as to make the need for this gesture obsolete. And we have an example of that in Canada, going back to about 84, 86, when some of you may remember Dr. Gifford Jones and the very public fight to legalize heroin in Canada. the argument being that, you know, morphine didn't work. And the real story was we weren't using morphine properly. And after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, complex legislation was set forth. Heroin was made available in a restricted way, but coupled with a very intense education program. And 3 or 4 years later, the supplier of heroin communicated to the federal government, I guess it was, and said, you know what, we're not providing this anywhere. There has been no demand. Why? We changed the way we started to approach palliative care. It was an enormous transition. We're not all the way there yet. And I think what you and the legislation do is provide another lever in that direction.
I've also heard, and I'll turn to Veronique, I've also heard actually the opposite story, the suggestion that the act would trigger negative outcomes for palliative care, that it would bring people to think immediately of assisted dying, not to consider the steps that could be taken before, that resources might be taken away from palliative care units. Are you worried that this might be the perverse effect of the legislation?
Au Québec, on l'a pas du tout abordé de cette manière.
In Quebec, we didn't approach it in this way. We have a much more global, wide approach. There were a number of other things that were done at the same time when we introduced the law, the bill. We think of the Netherlands or Belgium, where legislation has also been presented. We saw also an augmentation in access to palliative care. So the literature shows us the opposite. The public debate, the public conversation around the end of life, the idea of exchanging and having a real debate, a public debate in the public square around these questions brings a lot of interest, shines a lot of light on the issues of the, around end of life, and so the whole society becomes involved also in the positive effects for palliative care and improvement in that area. And I didn't see anyone in all of the hearings we held who were dreaming to have, you know, to use assisted dying. Even the great activists would say to you that they would dream of dying in their sleep. And so, but what they do wish for is that if the worst case scenario happens, a bit like an emergency exit, that possibility exists, that it be there in real time, but also during the illness itself, so that they know that if that were to happen, there would be that option available to them. And that is also a factor that helps their own mental health, their own state of mind, their own peace of mind. And so I think for doctors, this is something enormous to wrap their minds around. But what we see in the population, for most people, it's not such a huge thing to go beyond that barrier, to go take that step, because many people have accompanied people dying. They have seen circumstances, they've seen slow increments, sometimes large increments in morphine and other forms of sedating people. I'm not saying that it's the same thing, but they have witnessed, they've seen that for them, in their understanding, these are things that also lead to death, even if, of course, morphine and increasing its doses don't lead directly to death. We understand that. I'm not saying that. But that there is, nonetheless, all kinds of circumstances of supports and aid that is offered in the last days of life. And there's a certain lack of comprehension. Why are some things so correct from a medical point of view, but that a suicide or medical help for dying would not be allowed? So for the average Joe in the street, putting yourself in the place of the person who's accompanying, often this whole discussion on values, they feel there's a certain hypocrisy involved. And that explains a little bit of a difference in terms of where some doctors are on this issue, who are working on palliative care and who understand all the nuances, and the general population who perhaps might be somewhere else. So we need to take this into account. And the other thing I wanted to say is that if in 30 or 40 years science has reached a point where it's obsolete, then we can change the law. You know, it's a law is made for a particular moment in time. I know there are a lot of people who fear this, and they say, on the contrary, by introducing this law, we're opening the doors a little bit more, and then they'll be open wider and wider. But a law belongs to a certain time, a reality in a certain moment in history for a certain need. And of course it can evolve in one way or another, and it's not fixed. The number of laws that we change every year, modify every year, prove that. So I'm not saying this law is now fixed in time on one side or the other.
Harvey, est-ce que nous jouons un peu avec les mots? C'est-à-dire, est-ce qu'il y a des différences qualitatives entre différentes choses qui mènent à la mort?
You look at the spectrum of medical responses and choices also made by the patient. One can move from withholding treatment or refusing treatment to withdrawing treatment that's already begun if it's life-sustaining, to assisted suicide through the prescription of lethal drugs to the patient that the patient would take himself or herself, all the way to direct action by the physician that will provoke the death of the patient. Is there a qualitative difference between all of these things? Is there a line to be drawn somewhere here?
Well, I think there's a line of sorts. And you articulate it very well with those four steps. If you look at the first two, withdrawal of support or someone who decides they don't want to have treatment, what they're really saying is let the natural processes move on. Let them play out. We're all going there someday, so let them play out and keep me comfortable while I do that. When you take the next two steps, you are crossing a kind of line which is quite different from disconnecting the respirator. All right? If you disconnect the respirator, then the natural process is this person couldn't have breathed beforehand. All right? But if you now say, okay, they're breathing all right, they're not dependent on technology to stay alive, but they are suffering and they want us to depart from the natural process, that is a line that causes a lot of difficulty for people going back from to the days of the Hippocratic Oath, which says, we respect the end of life, we respect the natural processes that are there, we understand that they're not always smooth and easy and clean and simple and, you know, like good movies, not bad movies. But that's our limit, all right? That's, if you will, the ultimate humility of a physician who says, I can only do so much, but I will keep you comfortable. And what makes some physicians really uncomfortable, apart from, if you will, religious or moral things, which I don't think we want to go to, it's the feeling that this is very different than anything I've been asked to do. I'm happy isn't the word, but I can turn off the respirator because I understand I'm only allowing thus a natural process to take place. So I think there is that kind of difference.
Je pense, si je peux me permettre, c'est vraiment...
This is very important because it's true that legally, medically, there's a big difference between unplugging someone from a respirator versus administering a medical assistance in dying. You know, though, that there have been cases, there have been witnesses who have come to our hearings. I remember a Monsieur Thériault whose wife was 40 years old and she was on a respirator. And the process with the spouse, with the kids, with the doctors to decide that this was the point, that they had had enough. It took many, many months. It was a process that was very important, very charged, very difficult. It's not mundane. And for some people, for citizens who are not lawyers, who are not doctors, the line is very tenuous. And they don't think in terms of the natural sickness is going to follow its course. For someone who's 25, for someone who's 40, who's someone who's 60, who's going to stop dialysis, who's going to unplug a respirator, but who could live much longer if they were still plugged in or was still following the treatment, versus someone who is at the very, very end of life and for whom they only have 2 or 3 or 4 weeks left. And we say to that person, no, unfortunately, it's not possible to shorten your life, even if you have suffering that you find intolerable, because from a medical point of view or a legal point of view, we cannot. Of course, everyone understands that these two things are not the same. But for people who are sick, the idea, the sense of all of this is very
it's very difficult to establish it. Why would society say yes? On the one hand, there's no problem. It's been recognized for many years in the civil code, for 25 years, the possibility of stopping all treatment, no matter what age. We have cancer. We have 80% of getting out, but we don't want to take chemotherapy and radiation. We can say no. But why is somebody at the very end of life who is suffering extremely cannot also have assistance to die? These are dilemmas and situations that people, the average person in the street, who we also have to represent as legislators, as politicians, we have to take them into account. Jire Harvey.
Intervention. One response is the fundamental principle response that says under no circumstances would this kind of direct intervention by a physician to put someone's life to an end be acceptable, under no circumstances. And then another response is a prudential response, mm-hmm. which suggests that, leaving aside this very difficult moral question, if we're going to go in the direction that is taken here and that the Supreme Court suggests is now the constitutional requirement in Canada, we need to have some safeguards, and there are no ways to actually build up the safeguards to guarantee that there will not be any abuse or that we won't slide down the slippery slope. Do you think we can set up some parameters that would make this a bit more acceptable?
Well, you're just going to have the anxiety on the other side of the equation. All right? You're going to, instead of the anxiety of, you know, maybe someone is going to suffer longer than they need to suffer, we're going to translate it into an anxiety that maybe people will suffer less and treatment will be less offered and people will be less supported. So you're trading one anxiety for another. And I'm not sure that's as well understood as it might be. But I wanted to come back, Veronique, to a couple of things you said. You talked about people in the very last days of their life who, in effect, say, hey, I know I'm dying in a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And, you know, why can't we make the decision to end this, you know, now? And you talk about the complex, time-consuming, but very valuable discussions around families and concerned others around those decisions. Now, that's going to be no different than withdrawing life support from a ventilator. You know, that's the same conversation, that's the same angst, and it'll have different manifestations because now you're offering, you know, an actual active gesture. But you phrase that in terms of those kind of cases. Yet, in fact, the cases that drove the legislation were people with a much longer horizon. You know, Sue Rodriguez and the current case were people who weren't dying of cancer. They had neurodegenerative diseases, and the horizon was very long. Or let's put it this way, a lot longer than 3 or 4 weeks. So the case you make about ease it earlier is quite different than the circumstances that drove the interest. So help me reconcile those.
Oh, moi je pense que les deux. C'est sûr que c'est pas juste.
It's not just people who are 2 or 3 weeks from dying, although those people also came to our hearings. We also heard from them in terms of prolonged agony. We shouldn't minimize those cases. They're also important. Pain that we can't control, there's no solution to, permanent sedation and so on. For some people, this is something that creates a great deal of anguish, a great deal of anxiety. People can't sleep for 2 or 3 weeks because of it. I know a physician who saw a case of someone who was dehydrated and hadn't been sleeping for 3 weeks. So semantically and also medically, where do we make the difference? I think there's a clear difference, but for some people there isn't. There are people who have degenerative illnesses, and that's also why I think that we need this aid assistance in dying, and I think the Supreme Court showed as well in their ruling. And palliative care is necessary too, but for right now, palliative care is not sufficiently adapted to some of these degenerative cases. Because the development of palliative care was often very much
put the emphasis on cancer and on other conditions. I know there are other experts here who know a lot more about this than me, but many people said that we're starting to develop it more for degenerative illnesses, but there is still a challenge. We still have to go further in that area. But those people also might find themselves in a situation of suffering, continual suffering, intolerable continual suffering, in an irreversible situation, and may want to have that possibility available to them so that they will not have to live for months. But I think this is a legitimate question that we need to find an answer to.
How would you characterize suffering? Is it pain? Is it, what would be the other words to expand on the definition of suffering that then, in a sense, would fall within the qualification that whoever is making this decision would consider?
Ben, je dirais que c'est de la douleur, c'est de la souffrance, c'est...
It's pain, it's suffering, it's a form of agony of patients. Patients were telling us, that they were saying every minute that passes is like 1 hour. That's the state of discomfort, of pain, of anxiety that I'm in. There can be suffering that's also moral, that's existential, and it can be enormous and very difficult to control without creating hallucinations or other effects. Very difficult effects to deal with for someone who wants to, maintain a certain amount of consciousness and wants to have a relationship with their loved ones. I'm in a state. Well, I can't say how you would qualify it scientifically. I think doctors, particularly palliative care doctors, and those who are suffering can explain it. You talk to a patient, they can explain 1 to 10 and can explain it with many, many words. They can evaluate and make the difference between a sore toe, a sore tummy, and a sore head, or the suffering at the end of a cancer or the end of a very degenerative illness. We've had many, many expressions of these feelings in our hearings, how their loved ones lived this through this agony as well, that every minute is an eternity, and excessively difficult to live through, when you're tossing and turning in your bed, to lift yourself up even a little bit is difficult. You're completely contracted, you're completely doubled over. I think palliative care, generally speaking today, does deal with a lot of these situations, but I think it's mostly suffering, yes. And also psychic and psychological suffering at the end of life.
Bill 52 is a complicated piece of legislation. It sets up a number of conditions before any decision is made on end of life and assisted dying. I was reading a couple of weeks ago, and maybe some of you saw that in the National Post, report of a survey that outlined the level of confusion among healthcare professionals, physicians in Quebec about what's legal right now, what might be made legal after the legislation comes into force, to the level of extreme confusion, honestly. And that raises the question how we're going to ensure that whatever conditions are set in the Act are actually going to turn into the results that you anticipated as part of the legislation. And conversely, I would say, if you read the decision of the Supreme Court and its conclusion, you will find that the court found the criminal code provisions that prohibit assisted suicide are of no force or effect to the extent that they, and I'm reading now, prohibit physician-assisted death for a competent adult who clearly consents to the termination of life and has a grievous and irremediable medical condition, including an illness, disease, or disability that causes enduring suffering that is intolerable to the individual in the circumstances of his or her condition. Not easy to apply either. Those are very difficult standards. So I'm interested in hearing what both of you think of the actual implementation of this idea, the operationalization of the idea of assisted death, either in the legislative context of Quebec or in a more open-ended standard that I've just read from the Carter decision.
J'aimerais dire quelque chose sur le sondage.
I would like to say something about the survey, because it's incredible. This survey is about the knowledge of physicians and their knowledge of Bill 52, and it
was carried out before the bill was even presented. Not even before the debate, but before it was even presented in the National Assembly. So it's incredible that this survey has been published now, even though it was carried out in 2013. And the National Post is trying to say no one in the health sector understands this bill. I was writing it at the time that this bill was survey was carried out. Now, however, that having been said, we have seen some exaggerations and some hyperbolism in the media on both sides, the pro and the con, that use information in a somewhat irresponsible way. So I want to just put that within its right context. But the other thing I would say is that, of course, nothing is perfect. And one of the big areas where we still have to do work, and I'm not there anymore doing this work, I'm not in the government anymore to be able to follow up on all of this and to put in place and to operationalize this law. But when I left, there were there were at least 8 different areas that people were working on. One that is fundamental, and finally, is yes, that nurses and doctors and social workers, first of all, know what palliative care is, but believe it or not, even in the medical context, even in the healthcare context, there are lots of people who don't know enough about it. But also the distinction between different treatments, refusing treatment, medical assistance with dying, and other, you'd be amazed to know how many doctors don't know about sedation, who just think that it's, you know, injecting morphine. All of these concepts in the past, we realized during our work, were not unanimously understood within the sector by doctors. But I would say that the work we were doing for 4 years in Quebec, the law, the report of the commission, were also tools that allowed to inform the public and the healthcare professionals, but also to help these teams, healthcare teams, to better understand. You know, for 25 years, you didn't realize that your patients had the right to refuse certain treatments. Not only do you need to know that, but you need to go further. There's a whole new step we need to take. So this is a fantastic opportunity to better master all of these concepts.
I think it's going to be hugely difficult to implement for exactly the reasons you put out. Whether or not that survey was done while you were writing the legislation or not, I sat down a few weeks ago with a group of medical people and law students and the Privacy Commissioner in Ontario and the President of the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario, and they had homework in advance, so they'd read the Supreme Court thing, they'd read your bill, they'd read a whole bunch of things. And in this group of people who did homework beforehand, there was huge confusion about what it actually meant, what the process was to be. And at the end of the day, we sort of said, you know, everybody's focusing on a process here, and it's a process that isn't linked to really understanding what the outcome is going to be. And this goes back to that theme I did raise earlier on, that if you're going to do this, you're going to make a series of decisions, and the real moral hazard, the greater one for me, is the moral hazard of, fine, you do this, and a certain number of people come through that process at the end of a year, and we've assisted them to die earlier than they might otherwise have died, and nobody goes and says, okay, what did we learn for this? Did we do it right? Were all their needs met? We will have satisfied a process somehow. All right? We'll within all the ambiguities that the Supreme Court legislation leaves, and I dare say Bill 52 leaves, we'll have come up with a process. You'll have set up some adjudication committee. They're going to do it. And then there's going to be silence at the end. And we're not going to know whether we've done this properly. And that, for me, is the greater moral hazard.
Est-ce que vous savez en ce moment si...
Do you know at this time when you withdraw a treatment, Do you know if you're doing well? Do you know when, if all the support was given? Do you know if people who are in palliative care really have a feeling of having been accompanied perfectly? I mean, all these questions are asked even now. So why all of a sudden would they be asked in a totally new way for the medically assisted death? I mean, I think these questions should be asked for all the end-of-life situations, no matter what happens, what would give comfort to person. I mean, that's the issue. And we have to improve the accompaniment of the people at the end of life. But I don't think we have to segment according to the fact that somebody has or not has recourse to this form or exceptional form of help, which is the medical assisted suicide or end of death, end of life. So I think that the fact that of having brought this discussion back in the public sphere could only help us. And thank God in Quebec, it's not the judgment of the Supreme Court that will have shown the pathway, because everybody in Canada doesn't have any choice, because Supreme Court has just indicated what people have to do. We at least have a couple of yards ahead of time, and with a debate, we've debated already in the civil code on all the questions of care, health care, and we now have 5 years of work and public consultation. So I think that that's a great plus that we have in respect to for the good, the well-being of people. Of course, it's a process. What we're looking for is the wellness of people. That's the purpose. That's the main focus that has to be ours.
Last question, Cappy, before we open the floor to the audience, and maybe you can gather your questions and we will pose them to the speakers. So I guess what you're both saying leads me to the obvious question. Do we really need legislation? Could we not just trust the doctors and palliative care units to do the right thing? They've been doing it for quite some time. Legislation just sends strange messages about what's acceptable and what's not acceptable in society. Can we not trust them to do what they're supposed to be doing? Accumulate the wisdom that they normally would accumulate, teach one another? Right? Do we really need this? And then I might add, do we really need a legislation in Quebec that might trigger particular responses that will be different in other provinces? This is not a federal matter exclusively. It could be a provincial matter. We could have a whole range of legislation in the different provinces that would be quite different. So is it a bad idea to legislate in this case? I mean, coming from the Dean of Law, this may sound a bit strange, but the skill of lawyers, as Véronique will know, is to figure out when it is that you should legislate and when you should not, right? So is this a case where we shouldn't, actually? Is this dangerous terrain?
Well, like from the outset, we in Quebec, we could have said that we especially don't want, as legislators, stop on the question, and that we would do like everywhere in the rest of Canada or federal and find out that the courts tell us what to do. I was convinced that when I tabled the motion that created the commission, that on the contrary, when there's a topic as sensitive as this and fundamental as this and touched all the citizens, because we will all have to face death one day. So I felt that it was important that the electors have their opinion. And I was much more of an opinion that it was a question of courage, legislative courage, that we had to therefore commit this discussion with people, into this discussion with people, rather than being imposed by the court decision. The rest of Canada made another choice. Fine. But they're in the same situation we are. And I would say, according to me, they're a lot less comfortable to having now, after a year, they have 6 or 7 months to try and come to some kind of legislation that will have established a consensus that the doctors, the nurses, the moralists, the lawyers, and the population will be able to all accept in such a short time frame. So I'm very happy that we did what we did in Quebec. And why? Did we have to legislate? Well, sometimes with the Supreme Court, we have to do what we have to do. What I think was a good idea for two principles. If we left this up into hands of the private relationship between the patient and his or her doctor, then there could be problems of equity, because, of course, not doctors don't have the same values, don't have the same ways of dealing with the question of end of life, and therefore you see also a difference of philosophies, or one goes to palliative care, in other words, something different. Some want care at the home. So it's not the patient then that has the last word in respect to all of this, a professional word. Some people say, some professionals will say, leave it in our our hands. When it's really, really bad, we will know what to do for you. The fact is that the answers that we had during our surveys were, it's not always the same. And secondly, I think that for foreseeability, I think it's important for people to know what they can have or what they can't have in terms of health care at the end of their life, so that they can foresee how, during their sickness, what the end of life could look like.
Just had not put their fingers in that soup.
Well, I come, by the way, from a family of lawyers, and yes, I think we'd probably be happier if they hadn't, but at the end of the day, you know, the storm will pass. I don't think creating a piece of legislation will make this necessarily easier. Because to give you a very trivial example, you do this and compare the availability of resources to someone living, say, within a mile of where we're sitting today, or in a small community in northern Quebec. And they have otherwise the same illness, the same suffering, and the resources aren't there in the smaller community for whatever reasons. And lo and behold, they start to call on the ending of life service, whatever it's called, because the community hasn't provided that resource to them. And that's a pretty frightening kind of way out. By legislating it, you put that, in a sense, right on the table and turn it over to government and say, hey, you guys, you committed to a healthcare system, right? Mm-hmm. You're going to be here for us. And guess what? You've now given me the avenue to end my life because, you know what, you're not going to provide that palliative care up in a small community in northern Quebec that I could get in Montreal. Now, Madam Premier, or Véronique, when you're Premier,
Merci pour le vote de confiance.
Hey! You know, far worse things could happen.
I don't know if we wanted to advise somebody who's wise to do that. So,
Cap, you turn the floor over to the audience. We have some questions that people want to bring forward. I think we have some people who will gather the questions and bring them here. I'm sorry, I'm actually getting older and I'm deaf, and I really can't hear what you're saying. So, well, bring it forward. Bring it forward. Someone will pick it up. Okay, so I have, there are some people who are actually quite creative here. Let me start with a short question. With budget cuts in the health system, how can access to palliative care be increased from the current 30% availability?
Okay.
Well, first of all, 30% is not an adequate number. It's a number that has existed since the year 2000, so it was before the policy on palliative care. It's therefore before the significant development we've known in Quebec for more than 10 years now, and it was before, I think we have, since that figure, we have three times more beds available, three times more houses for palliative care. It's a very significant development of palliative care in homes also, or at home. We have to know that there's been an important development given to the, over the last years, to the palliative care and targeted investment, I'd like to say, for the very first time. So is everything perfect? No, I would say that it's not perfect. But perfect, in, surprisingly, I had a discussion with some experts of palliative care who said that the access was rather good and it was greatly improved. Now the question is, now with everything that's happening, will palliative care, will they be cut? Well, we hope not. But I have a lot of exchange with the Minister of Health in respect to this, and who repeats his commitment that he's supposed to very soon come up with an action plan for the existence of palliative care, as well as for the whole question of against pain. Now, but even if I'm very critical, and I don't want him to do any policy, but I critique the government's stance, but I'm quite confident and trusting in respect to this issue because it is implicitly linked to the Bill 52, and you know that in view of all the electoral deadlines, finally, it was accepted at the 12th hour when I said the government was adopted finally with a new government. And it was the first law that has two names of ministers on it from two different parties. So I think that there is a commitment on the part of the new government to have access to palliative care.
Véronique, I have one here for Harvey, so okay. I'm going to turn that one over to you while I sort the questions for Véronique. Why are most palliative care physicians against Law 52? They take care of these patients every day with passion and care. What would they propose as more acceptable legislation?
Well, I don't want to speak for my palliative care colleagues, and there are a number in the audience who can probably address this better than I. In the first instance, I have come to the conclusion that, from talking with many of them, that the problem is when seen from the real coalface, where this is really happening, is not the large problem that's perceived by some people to be in the community. That we have a perfect system? No. But that we have a whole means of relieving suffering in the broad holistic context, whether it's existential, whether it's the suffering that patients who are coming to their end of their days and haven't resolved family conflicts, whether it's pain, they can manage them quite well. I don't think they have a definitive answer, and I can tell you from my conversations with a number of palliative care groups that the issue, even within those groups, can be deeply divisive. Are individual palliative care physicians comfortable being part of that system? To give an incomplete answer, we go back to my first sentence, and they say, when you're at the coalface, this isn't as large an issue as the much greater ones facing our healthcare system, the delivery of adequacy of care. And I can say this from a global perspective. You know, the ability to give the basic, meet the basic requirements to ease people's suffering is not just a Canadian concern, it's a global concern. And as you relieve those concerns, the sense of, oh my God, I'm going to be left alone, become less. And the palliative care people, I think, are closer to that every day, which is why I'm perceiving, and I'm looking in the audience at a couple of my colleagues here and friends who are palliative care physicians, I hope I'm not representing their perspective.
So one quick question. Maybe Véronique can explain why medical aid in dying was chosen as the proper terminology as opposed to euthanasia, which people would recognize.
Okay. Well, euthanasia, in fact, is a word that's used a lot, but as you know, that through the tragic examples of history, is not linked up to the medical context, but nor that the request should come from the person who is sick. And that's something we didn't talk much about because I hadn't enough time to involve myself in details of those conditions. But of course, it's the most important criteria, is that at all time the request has to come from the person herself or himself, for his himself or herself, and by himself or herself. That's why for us the expression was good. That's an expression we created, the help in medical help to die, and it's the help that's the word, important word. Person who's asking for help, to be helped, in respect to their pain at the end of life, and it's a medical context because the medical context is a continuum of care and is fundamental for the concept, which is not found in the expression euthanasia as such.
Raise the issue of vulnerable populations. Some have to do with disability, incompetent individuals, and so on. Do you think that safeguards that can be imagined, either in the shape that they've taken in Bill 52 or in some other shape, can protect those vulnerable communities from abuse, from stigmatization, or being singled out in these processes?
It's
for both.
I think that the fundamental key here is that it's a request from the person herself or himself. So evidently, if we start saying we're going to eliminate all people who are cost too much to a healthcare system, because that's something we hear from time to time during the work of our commission, we heard those kinds of comments, or that could be horror stories. And so that's why That's not what the law says. The law says that we want to help and accompany people at the end of life cycle, and that the person has to ask it herself or himself in such a way. There's a process that is a very formal process to follow through. First med doctor, second doctor, the person has to be apt to consent. So all this is very present. And what is interesting to note is that not only the legal experts in Quebec looked at this, on the law. In other words, the report of the commission and the law itself, there had been a request made to the experts committee of lawyers. They said that the law, like the Supreme Court said the same thing in their decision, that laws would come and improve the protection of the vulnerable people, because at now there is nothing to protect the people who are vulnerable. Yes, we're opening the door to a new form of help, medical help to die, and that's true. But at the same time, we're doing this particularly because there are people who are very suffering, who become very vulnerable at the end of their lives, and that we want to be able to offer them an answer. But also, in respect to the present situation, where I would like to remind you that people can, for a certain family member to have continuous sedation, can decide that we're going to stop a treatment or we're going to unplug the respirator. And right now, we want to clarify this, and for medical help to die, it would be much more public, framed, surrounded, and given with the criteria.
People had protection before the Supreme Court decision because any form of assisted dying was illegal. All right, so that was a pretty profound protection, if you want to call it that, from a legal perspective. But let's go to the bedside for a moment, where the real action is. And these are very subtle, complex conversations, and how much is independent view. And one of the tales I was told was of a patient who was contemplating continuous sedation and wanted to be out of it. And he had two daughters. And after conversations with one daughter, he said, okay, I'll have the sedation. And then the other daughter would come in and he'd have a conversation. No, I don't think I want to have the sedation. And it's not a simple notion of the patient as an isolated individual with complete autonomy and being able to, to exercise that independently and cleanly all the time. These conversations are necessarily difficult, particularly for families that may not have, may have issues within the family at the time. They're difficult when there are choices and options around treatment. They're difficult when the level of suffering changes from moment to moment. So you're never going to get away from the vulnerability issue. I don't think this making this act legal removes the vulnerability. I think it shifts it, and so I don't think we're a net gain on that. What we've done is open an avenue, a different avenue of abuse than we currently had.
So a number of the questions raise the question or context of sedation and highlight the fact that currently there may be instances in which patients are put into deep sedation without nutrition and hydration. And some people ask, what is the difference between that and active intervention that achieves euthanasia? And then conversely, other people say, well, since that's available, why do we need something more that would really take us to another level in our response to end-of-life circumstances? So I guess the question is for both of you. And then one slight spin on this, one person is asking how sedation got to be in the act, because as people know, perhaps there's a specific provision that addresses sedation as distinct from aid in dying.
Okay.
And that will be the last question. Cappy will close after this, I think. We're at 7:10. I'm following my orders very precisely.
Okay.
Continuous palliative sedation is in the law because it's not something that's banal or trivial. So we became aware that there was a lot of confusion in respect to the concept, as I said earlier on. For some people, sedation, constant sedation was morphine doses and all of that, whereas sedation, palliative sedation, constant, which is called terminal, when they ask, we use continuous and not terminal, because we were listening to the people in this process. The fact is to put somebody in a state, almost like a coma or a deep sedation, until the point where death occurs. So often people at this moment will not eat anymore. Some people will still be hydrated, but we stop feeding, which is rare, but we stop even sedation, hydration. And what happens with this in some cases, might last long. So this is something that is less reflected on for people who have degenerative sicknesses. So people might have for many months to live. So tell that person, stop feeding yourself, and then you're going to become a potential candidate to some kind of palliative, continuous palliative sedation. Then we'll be able to give you the only care, the only possibility is there for you, in view of the state of suffering that we can't control at this time. So it's for that, because that's very complex. It's also something for the families. The family might consent, because presently there may be a substitute consent. We thought that this would be something that would require certainly a specific consent. And we give clear explanations, so that's why we said there has to be a written consent, because we felt that it's something that's not trivial. And to know why this is not sufficient, well, I think that with the example of the degenerative sicknesses that I just explained, but also because for many people, this is something that challenges them and makes them excessively anxious to think that they're going to be put asleep without waking up until death arrives, and that their family will be there at their side during 2 days, 4 days, 8 days, 12 days, they never know. And so this is something that is not in conformity to certain will of some persons and in respect to some kinds of sicknesses.
This is where the legal and medical worlds have different perspectives. Legal world, I think, quite appropriately tries to articulate, you know, distinctions. And as an oncologist, as physicians, as palliative care physicians, we appreciate that there aren't black and white distinctions. So to give you an example of continuous sedation versus, if you want to call it, the unassisted natural process, you will often encounter patients who in their last days, as we would say, lapse into unconsciousness, lapse into a coma. All right, that's, if you will, a naturally occurring form of continuous sedation. And what happens when that happens? Well, they stop eating, and the normal protective mechanisms, for example, of coughing to clear your lungs and other things, slowly cease. And so whether it's pneumonia, which has always been known as the old man's friend, is what takes you away, or something else happens, that's the natural course of events. My sense of continuous sedation is that, in effect, it aids and assists almost the same kind of process, because when you have continuous sedation, you're not going to be having your secretions drained, and all of the same kind of things happen. So I think here is the case of making a distinction when, in fact, there isn't a distinction. What we're really trying to do is ease people's, all of our ultimate departures from this life in a way that minimizes suffering, to use an overused phrase, not only, by the way, for the patient, but for those who are important to the patient in their world. And that's the broad construct that I think we need to think about. So it goes right back to the earliest part of our discussion this evening, when, as we you know, live our life journey. You know, as Ecclesiastes would say, there's a time for this and a time for that, and it's the journey. And what we're obligated to do as physicians from infancy through death is to play a role in making that journey better. And end of life is a piece of that role. And I think we got to continue driving at it, and I really do mean it, to say that the legislation you put on the ground and then the further move of the Supreme Court is a driver for our healthcare system to say, hey, wait a minute, we've taken on responsibility for, if you will, the wellness trajectory of people throughout their lives. And we've got to stand back and look at ways to make this better in the face of extraordinary technologies that have come our way. We weren't having this argument, you know, 100 years ago, before we had antibiotics, before we had ventilators, before we had chemotherapy drugs. But now that we have these really, really powerful tools, and we've charged in and we've started using them in ways that maybe are technologically ahead of our moral and societal ways to figure out how they work, that's where we've got to have work to do. And the focus really isn't on the last moments of life and do we allow a mechanism that allows physicians or their surrogates or somebody to end it sooner. Say, wait a minute, got to look at this whole trajectory. And that's education for us, it's education for our physicians, it's a real challenge to government, which has taken upon itself to be the protector of our wellness and is confronted by the fact that this juggernaut extraordinary medicine has in some ways gotten a little bit ahead of us. So I commend you for what you've done. It's an extraordinarily brave thing to do, especially in the view of conversations I've had with some major political leaders. I think it's a way step. I don't think it's a solution.
I think that might be actually the perfect point to end this conversation. I'm still holding maybe 24 questions that were not raised, and you'll be happy to know that there is a reception out there, and you can corner our speakers and really ask your question if you have to have an answer tonight. Otherwise, just join the reception and be merry. And on this, I turn the floor over to Dr. Cruz.
Thank you very much. I think we've had an extraordinary evening. Harvey mentioned Ecclesiastes. One of my very favorite sayings from Ecclesiastes is, "For of the Most High cometh healing." That was actually over the door of the Vanderbilt Clinic in New York where Sylvia and I trained, and it's something that's never left me. I think what we're participating in is a continuing dialogue that society is having with itself. We're engaged in an evolution of attitudes. And it's important that these things be discussed. If we look at it in the terms of, "For of the Most High cometh healing," my personal feeling is that the Supreme Court decision and Madame Yvonne's very wonderful law are not involved in killing. I frankly think they're involved in healing, in the sense that our palliative care physicians have taught me about healing. I'm sure many people will disagree with me, but that's how I feel, and I think it's important that people say how they feel in society. Margot Somerville taught me that. So on your behalf, we just have to thank the panelists for their very wonderful contributions, for participating in a civil discourse on very difficult issues. And I'd like to present on behalf of all of us some tokens of our appreciation. And I think we would be grateful if you would all thank our panelists. Now, their reception, turn left. It's in front of Moise Hall. We would be delighted to see you all there. Please hand in your headsets so that you can get your IDs back. And thank you all for coming.